Sometimes I learn under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Patron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, but above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself, see if these things be true.
Welcome, folks. Happy Tuesday, and hope everybody had a good long weekend. We are continuing to work our way through the book of Yirmiyahu or Jeremiah. This is, of course, the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Tanakh edition, where we talk about some of the other things in the Bible that don't get quite as much play because they're not part of the regular Torah cycle. And again, of late, it's been the prophets, and there's a lot in this book. Right now, and for the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about various prophecies against places and people groups as a result of what's fixing to come down. And obviously, there are a lot of parallels, and that certainly is a continuing item of interest. Anyway, last week we ended in the early 20s, and we're going to pick it up with the burden or the judgment that is going to fall on Damascus. And, of course, we know that Damascus is still a city. Before I read this, I'll note that Isaiah 17:1 talks about Damascus being a ruinous heap, and certainly the implication is that Damascus isn't going to be Damascus anymore.
What happened? So there,
go ahead, Mark.
I'm sorry, I just lost you guys for a minute.
Okay, well, we're hearing you. Anyway, that Damascus would cease to be a city, and this is another place where we're going to see a prophecy that's talking about Damascus, and it says this in verse 23 of chapter 49, Yirmiyahu, against Damascus, Hamath and Arpad are shamed, for they have heard bad news. They're faint-hearted. Trouble on the sea. It cannot be quiet. Damascus has grown feeble. She turns to flee, and fear has seized her. Anguish and sorrows have taken her like a woman in labor. Why is the city of praise not deserted, the city of my joy? Therefore, her young men shall fall in her streets, and all the men of war shall be cut off in that day, says Yahuwah Zevuot. I will kindle a fire in the wall of Damascus, and it shall consume the palaces of Ben-Hadad. And with that, we'll say good afternoon, and we'll go to MP. Let him weigh in on what he wants to talk about here.
Good afternoon, y'all. Here's Mark, and I'm happy to say that Ken and Mark Call are all with me here today. This is really good. We're going to have a wonderful time. Verses 23 to 27. This short passage deals with the punishment of Damascus, the capital city of Aram, according to Azamra's commentary. Damascus may have been the largest city in the king's highway that is just east of the ridge overlooking the Jordan River Valley and points both north and south. The highway was likely the way that Israel traveled from the Gulf of Aqaba to their land on the west of the ridge. The Dead Sea is the lowest landlocked point on Earth, 1,388 feet below sea level. Nothing can flow out of it. Now, because Yah is dealing with those peoples and nations that fought Israel's return from Egypt to the land of their fathers, never really expecting them back, and that they worked against Israel because she was faithful to Yah, although in an on-again, off-again kind of way, depending on her kings and high priests, we're getting this brief description of why and how they were being judged. Hamath is both a valley and a town or a city about 80 miles north of Damascus. There is a ridge that crosses the Hamath Valley just south of the city of Hamath, where a river flows north to the Mediterranean Sea, only 15 or so miles from the Turkish Peninsula. On the west side of that ridge, water flows south to the Dead Sea and through another smaller valley to the Mediterranean Sea near Tyre. The King's Highway from Nineveh to Damascus used all of these valleys and ran north and south from about Carchemish in the northeast Iraq to the Dead Sea, with just a few short jogs around small hills that separate the river valleys. The Jordan begins just southwest of Damascus and the river that empties into the Mediterranean near Tyre has headwaters about 4 miles as the crow flies from the Jordan's headwaters. The two are flowing in similar directions, separated by only a low ridge. The topography is really pretty fascinating to me. That's why I'm going through it. Yah was in control of all that happened during Noah's flood when all of this took shape. Okay? And that's why it fascinates me. So, Hamath is confounded in verse 23 from the Hebrew 954, Bush, that's Beit Vav Shin, to deceive or disillusion, which tells me that Yah is doing it to Hamath and not that they are doing it to themselves, although Yah could make that happen too if he wanted to. And so is Arpad confounded, which is about 60 or so miles north of Hamath, which is, again, about 60 miles north of Damascus. The evil things that they heard may or may not be similar or the same, but since they are cities on what was called the King's Highway from Nineveh to Israel and then to Egypt, they may have heard exactly the same news. Nebuchadnezzar may be on the warpath. If my surmise above is correct, wanted to say something, Mark?
No.
Okay. If my surmise above is correct, Nebuchadnezzar didn't want his serfs fighting each other, because they may come to the realization that they should be fighting the Babylonian yoke that they're both in. So Nebuchadnezzar is probably sending some troops to quiet the internecine fight and get them back into quiescent mode. Damascus, in verse 24, is weak by comparison to her former formidable self. I think that she is trying to quell some mess between Hamath and Arpad before Nebuchadnezzar gets involved. Looks as if it may have been too little too late. Now Nev is coming from Hadad, and Hadad, or whomever was running Damascus now, is worried. Fear has seized her, like a woman in childbirth. I think that verse 25 begins a new paragraph or a parenthetical thought, a thing easy to see in this list of verses. The verse 25, city of praise or joy, must be Jerusalem. And every cross-reference in TSK is about Jerusalem. It is Yah speaking, so I don't think he's talking about Damascus or Babylon or any other town in between, like Hamath or Arpad. I think Yah is talking about the need for all these cities and their respective nations and kings to be put down and for Yerushalayim to be exalted. We'll see as we move toward the end of the book of Yirmiyahu. I will work with that idea assumed as fact, and Damascus as the city to be judged. Now, verse 26 is talking again about Damascus's comeuppance. Her, that is Damascus's young men, will fall in her streets. It's going to share a couple of TSK's references here. Verses 19 through 21, it says, for the voice, and this is right from the scripture here. For the voice of wailing is heard out of Zion. How are we spoiled? We are greatly confounded because we have forsaken the land because our dwellings have cast us out. Yet hear the word of Yah, O ye women, and let your ear receive the word of his mouth. And teach your daughters wailing and every one of her neighbor lamentation. For death is come up into our windows and is entered into our palaces, to cut off the children from without and the young men from the streets. That's Jeremiah 19:19-21. And also in Amos, the prophet, thus saith Yah in verse 3-5, for three transgressions of Damascus and for four I will not turn away therefrom, because they have threshed Gilead with threshing instruments of iron. But I will send a fire into the house of Hazael, which shall devour the palaces of Ben-Hadad. I will break also the bar of Damascus and cut off the inhabitants from the plain of Aben, and him that holdeth the scepter from the house of Eden, and the people of Syria shall go into captivity into Ker, saith Yah. That's in Amos chapter 1, verses 3-5. Now, verse 27, how does a fire get kindled in a stone wall? That's what it actually says there. and I will kindle a fire in the wall of Damascus, and it shall consume the palaces of Ben-Hadad. Okay? Now, where Ben-Hadad's palaces, were they all made of wood? I do not think this language is meant to be taken literally in Ben-Hadad's day, but they most certainly can be taken literally in the atomic age. Assad may not be a descendant of Hadad, but he also may be a direct descendant of Hadad. If Syria should be a part of a large, a league of area nations, as she has done in the recent past, the Yom Kippur War comes to mind, intent on destroying the modern nation of Israel, this prophecy may see a literal fulfillment in our days, and may it be so. That's what I got through verse 27. Okay, what do you got, Ken? Anything, or shall we read on?
Yeah, I commented on 23 to 27 the last time we were here, so I'd rather not repeat myself again.
Okay, good deal.
I think we can read on to at least through, 33 or
okay.
so.
I would think so. So you want me to do that, or is Mark here?
The next segment is called...
There he is.
There we go. It has to do with judgment on a couple of other places, Kedar and Hazar. And it says, against Kedar and against the kingdoms of Hazor, which Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, shall strike, thus says Yahuwah. Arise, go up to Kedar, and devastate the men of the east. Their tents and their flocks they shall take away. They shall take for themselves their curtains, all their vessels and their camels, and they shall cry out to them, saying, fear is on every side. Sounds like something that they would be talking about the Booga Booga Flu, doesn't it? Flee, get away, get far away, dwell in the depths, O inhabitants of Hazor, says Yahuwah. For Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has taken counsel against you and has conceived a plan against you. Arise, go up to the wealthy nations that dwell securely, says Yahuwah, which has neither gates nor bars, dwelling alone. Their camels shall be for booty, and the multitude of their cattle for plunder. I will scatter to all winds those in the farthest corners, and I will bring their calamity from all its sides, says Yahuwah. Hazor shall be a dwelling place for jackals, a desolation forever. No one shall reside there, nor son of men dwell in it. All right, let's go first to you, Ken, this time.
Okay, hopefully my screen's not going to black out like it's doing right now. Now, according to Wiki, because you know how we all love Wiki and we trust everything it says.
It's
got to
be true.
The Kedarites are described as the most organized of the northern Arabian tribes at the peak of its power in the 6th century BCE. The Kedarite kingdom appears to have encompassed a good portion of the northern part of the Arabian Peninsula and would have been to the south of the Babylonian Empire and east or east-southeast of Israel. Now, Hazor was a large Canaanite and Israelite city in Upper Galilee, north of the Sea of Galilee. King Shlomo, or Solomon, he fortified Hazor to defend the entrance into the kingdom from Syria and Assyria. There must have been various kingdoms occupying this area in the days of Yirmiyahu that Yah would judge. And Yah details what was important to them and thus what would be taken away, such as curtains and vessels and camels. Now they sound like a simple people. And as Yah did with Israel, he will do here with Kedar and Hazor and will scatter them to the four winds. He does recommend to those with ears to hear to flee and find a place of refuge, most likely alone, for their land will no longer be a dwelling place for man. And it seems that way even today, if you ever get into that part of the world, it's just so, I don't know, hot and, it's not easy to grow things there. It's a very dry land. It's, not a very desirable place to be. I don't see a whole lot of tourism going on there. But anyway, so that's what I have for the Cadorites in Hazor up through verse 33.
How about you, MP?
Okay, I got something here. Verses 28 to 33. This passage deals with Kedar and Hazor, whom Yah is going to make sure Nebuchadnezzar deals with as only he can. Hazor is a relatively small village north of Lake Kinneret or the Sea of Galilee. That it had a king is kind of strange. Here's a Zamra on this passage. They say, prophecy of the punishment of Kedar and the kingdom of Hazor. Radak states that Kedar and the children of the east mentioned in the verse are from the children of Ishmael. Verse 28 specifically states that it is Nebuchadnezzar who would strike them. This is because all the other nations mentioned by Jeremiah in these prophecies are of retribution, rather, are struck not only by Nebuchadnezzar, but also by others, whereas Kedar was struck only by Nebuchadnezzar. Now, in biblical history, we can see, this is me now talking, in biblical history, we can see the original kings of the east in Genesis 14, here and after, the king, K-O-E, okay, just short it up. They were Amraphel, which equaled Babylon, Arioch, which equaled Media Persia, Kedar Laomer, which equaled Greece and Eastern Europe, and Tidal equals Rome and Western Europe. The names of the kings and of their kingdoms is very interesting to me because I think it gives us some valuable insight into each one's character and possibly his purpose in this venture. First is Amraphel, king of Shinar, the Kasdim Chaldea. Okay, Shinar is Paleo-Babylon, and Amraphel was likely Nimrod himself. He would be the eldest and most senior of the in authority of the kings, even though this battle with Kedar Laomer in verse 5 and all the rest are just his, that is, lost his name. Anyway, they're all his allies, Kedar Laomer's allies. Now, I think it is probable that the list in verse 1 shows seniority of power, while the one in verses 5 and 9 shows that Kedar Laomer asked the other kings to help him quell the rebellion, and that he was in overall command of this operation. This is all Genesis 14 now, okay? These guys have been together for a long, long time. And these are the five kings of the east that came and attacked Sodom and Gomorrah and took Lot prisoner. And this is where we got introduced with Abraham the warrior. Okay, so anyway, that isn't all that we can glean from biblical history. When Israel came into the land after the Exodus, Yehoshua had done some great damage to the king of Jerusalem in that day, Adonizedek, whose local allies, the kings of Hebron, Yarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon, when the city and the king and the city of Gibeon made peace with Israel and paid tribute to Israel rather than be wiped out by them. These local kings in the land were interlopers from the east, taking advantage of Israel's absence. Notice that these interlopers were five in number, as were the kings of the east in Genesis 5 had been. In Genesis 14, the kings of the east took Lot. In Yehoshua, the four kings made alliance against Gibeon to teach that city a lesson. Yehoshua and Israel made mincemeat of the other four kings as per their deal with Gibeon. Now, these guys, in Jeremiah 49, were spiritual, ideological, and possibly also physical descendants of the kings of the east of Genesis 14 and Joshua 9. Scripture repeats itself over and over again because we just don't seem to get it. We think we are, when only Yah can possibly be, the measure of all things. Even in Israel's lesser holiness today, Yah is watching over them as per his agreement with Abraham. Meanwhile, those who do individually learn the lessons of Scripture will be the original population of the new earth as we see in Revelation 21:22, wherein only righteousness will dwell. Now in verse 30, Yah tells them, through Yirmiyahu, that Nebuchadnezzar is coming back to put down their biblically short-sighted action, as if it had been, they had had a clue about that. Nebuchadnezzar was more or less a hands-on ruler. He's all the way over in Babylon, not expecting any of, hands-off ruler, I'm sorry. He's all the way over in Babylon, not expecting any of his vassals to do anything ridiculous like these guys are doing. And when he has to make this at least 10-day trip to put down their lunatic uprising against his decree, it will not go well for them. Had Hazor just done as Nebuchadnezzar had decreed, they'd have lived an easy life, in verse 31. And it was Hazor, in rebellion, will be wiped out, and the descriptions are too clear to be dismissed. Okay, that's what I got through verse 33.
All right, let's go to Ken. I think.
I'm sorry. Let's see. Where are we at? That's through 33, right? No, I commented on that. Did we read through verse 39?
No, the question is just, are you ready? We'll continue if you are.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let's move along.
Okay, so, yeah, because we, so the next set has to do with a place called Elam, where it says, Yehuah, the king of Yirmiyahu, the prophet against Elam, and the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, saying the following. Now remember, time-wise, these are not necessarily in chronological order, so this is in the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah. Thus says Yehuah Zevuot, Lord of hosts, behold, I will break the bow of Elam, the foremost of their might. Against Elam I will bring the four winds from the four corners of heaven and scatter them toward all those winds. There shall be no nations where the outcasts of Elam will not go, for I will cause Elam to be dismayed before their enemies and before those who seek their life. I will bring disaster upon them, my fierce anger, says Yahuwah, and I will send the sword after them until I have consumed them. I will set my throne in Elam. I will destroy from there the king and the princes, says Yahuwah. But it shall come to pass in the latter days, I will bring back the captives of Elam, says Yahuwah. And that ends the chapter and the discussion of Elam. Let's go to you, MP.
Okay, this passage deals with Elam. The reign of Zedekiahu began in Anno Mundi 3328, B.C. 598 or to 600, in that neighborhood. Elam, the Elymais of the Greeks and Romans, was properly a province, rather, in the Persian Empire between Media and Sushan in Daniel 8:2. But sometimes the name Elam is used in a larger sense, including Susiana and other provinces. And you can see that in Daniel chapter 8 and verse 2. All of which were subdued by Nebuchadnezzar and afterwards restored and raised to dignity by Koresh. That's according to TSK. Now, Zedekiahu was king at the end of the Yehudi kingdom. Elam was a Shemite, and according to Genesis 10 and verse 22, Shem's eldest son. The children of Shem were Elam and Asher and Arphaxad and Lud and Aram. Now in verse 35, Yah Tzevaot says that he will break the bow of Elam. To hide or to withdraw is what the word means. It must be that Elam was known for its archers.
Don't take me soon,
cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more.
Do-do-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Come-a-come-a-dum-do-be-do-dum-dum. Keepin' Torah's a joy to do. Let's say that line, bound by the law, the 16 and many more. Don't they know what's really true? It's you, double me, and you. I keep the peace and troubles too. 6,000 years old, it's not new.
We are back, folks. This is the second half now of the first hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable. And let's see. We'll go to Ken, I guess. I thought we interrupted Mark. Maybe I was mistaken. But in any case, whoever was talking when the music came up, we didn't hear the last 20 seconds or so of that. So, MP says go ahead and go to Ken.
That was Mark, wasn't it? Oh, I'm sorry. What did you say, Mark?
Yeah, I was interrupted. That is true. I was I'm just looking for other stuff. But anyway,
go ahead and finish up then, bro.
Yeah, let me go ahead and okay. So in verses 34 to 39, this passage deals with Elam. The reign of Tzedekiyahu began in Anamundi 3328 or BC 598 or 600. Now Elam, the Elamais of the Greeks and Romans, was properly the province of Persian Empire between Media and Susanna. This is a Shushan in the Daniel 8:2. But sometimes the name Elam is used in the larger sense, including Susanna and other provinces. And then I'm going to look at my commentary for Daniel here. Remember when we did the book of Daniel a number of years ago? I'm going to get a couple of paragraphs out of here. In Daniel 2, two kings, emperors, are the stars of the chapters more than any of the others, Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, Belshazzar rather. Daniel is telling us that when he had the vision, though it had little to do with the fulfillment of or of the vision or the vision itself, the reference to the Ulai River in verse 2 tells us, lets us know rather approximately where and when the vision would be fulfilled. We can closely approximate what the identities of the actors in the visions are. And when the fulfillment took place in our past or Daniel's future, Belshazzar did not spend much over 2 years on the throne of Babylon before he was conquered, and that was at the end of chapter 5. So what the vision came to Daniel and in Belshazzar's third year says it came to him very near the time of the writing on the wall. Now, Shushan, or the town that occupies its space, was called Eulaus by the Greeks. The river Ulai may actually have been a 20-mile-long canal dug to bring water to the city from the present-day Karkei River, northeast of the town, and then flowed on to the Dez River a few miles to the west before flowing into the Tigris about 150 clicks west of the city. Susa should have been on the western slopes of the mountains east of the Tigris in present-day Iran. Now, Zamra's commentary is interesting about these paragraphs. The text now reverts to from Aramaic to Hebrew for the remainder of the book of Daniel. Chapters 2 through 7, which were in Aramaic, the lingua franca of the Babylonian and Persian empires, speak of Daniel's interactions with their rulers and the profound universal lessons they had to learn about how God deals with men measure for measure. In the coming chapters, the lessons are directed more specifically to Israel, yearning for the rebuilding of Jerusalem. And they contain a deep panemius, interesting word, panemius. It means interiority that Hebrew is uniquely fit to express. In the Chabad commentary, the aim of this is to reach panemius, inward or illumination, over hitzonius, which is outward light. Okay, Daniel records the graphic external images of his visions and then tells how angels come to him to interpret and explain them, thereby bringing him to the level of Bina, or understanding. We, in turn, must rely on Rav Saadia Gaon, Rashi, and the other great commentators who have come down to us to explain Daniel's visions. Okay, all of that as a background for what we're getting into here. Tzedek Yahu was the king at the end of the Yehudi kingdom. Elam was a Shemite, and according to Genesis 10:22, Shem's eldest son. In verse 35, Yah Tzevaot says that he will break the bow of Elam. To hide or to withdraw is what Elam means. It must be that Elam was known for its archers, because according to TSK, Strabo says that the mountainous part of Elamas chiefly bred archers. Okay, so that we get that from a Christian commentary. They pretty much agree. There is a region of the East Middle East called Elam, which roughly corresponds to western Iran along the Tigris River and the Persian Gulf. But the city that Yirmiyahu refers to is in Israel proper, or a bit to the north. Yah says that he is bringing the four winds from the four quarters of the heaven against Elam. Yah is going to scatter Elam to the, verse 36, winds, and there is nowhere other than her own land to which Elam will not come. My Sacred Bridge Bible Atlas doesn't give any location called Elam except a region north of Susa, to the east of the Tigris River. Who knows? Maybe Yah is referring to modern Iran and its destruction from all sides, hopefully before Iran builds more nuke weapons of mass destruction. Okay, so verse 37 and through 39 of our passage seems to say that Elam will be put to flight from her enemies. The way I see it, Elam's enemies under Yah's cattle prod will come against her from the four winds. The KJV seems to say that Elam's enemies will also have evil brought against them by Yah until he has destroyed them as well. After which, in verse 38, he will set himself a throne in Elam itself, and he'll destroy all those kings and princes that had put Elam and Yehuda under bondage. This would include all the empires that had destroyed the Israeli kingdom and Jerusalem. And it will happen in the here and now, not the there and then. That's what I got for the end of rest of this chapter.
Okay. Before we go to Ken, let me make just a quick observation, because what we're seeing here in the end of the book of Yirmiyahu is a whole bunch of judgments on various peoples, groups, and kingdoms that surrounded the land and some of the peoples. And certainly a lot of these groups go back historically. We see those that conquered, those that harassed, those that were problems. And I can't help but think if there's kind of an overriding thread that winds through here, it has to do with, all right, nasty stuff is going to happen to all of these folks. Several times it's mentioned in the ends of days. And it's almost like there is there's a score to be settled. And he is outlining all of these connections that are going to be, they may have been nasty for a while, and certainly there is judgment that is well deserved on Israel, but ultimately it's going to get sorted out. And as we look at the world today, I can't help but think, in a way, that's a whole lot of comfort too. Go ahead to Ken.
Yeah, I was going to actually mention a little something about that. But let me start out here with the fact that Elam was a bit more of a distant land to Israel than most, being situated to the east of the Babylonian Empire, at least according to the maps that I pulled up and looked at. But, of course, it's certainly not too far a reach for Yah and his judgments. Here we have yet another nation that Yah would scatter to the four winds of heaven. And as with all of the other heathen nations, their mighty ones would be brought down low and even broken. For, you know, Yah does this to give witness and proof to the fact that such gods have no power. And as a nation, they would be consumed by his fierce anger towards them. Of course, the anger is often built up because of their worshiping of other gods and walking in other ways, not the ways that he prescribes. and likened to Moab, mentioned in the last chapter, Elam's captivity would be brought again in the latter days. Now, we, like MC was saying, we should remember these nations that are to be seen again in the latter days, at least for proof or as a witnesses to the fact that we are in the latter days. So, in other words, I believe this is Yah's way of giving us additional facts to watch for, because remember, we're to be watchers in the latter days. So we're to watch for things that that he prophesies about, what he expects us to be watching for. And these are, you know, some people might not think back to the last few chapters of Yirmiyahu and think, oh, wait a minute, we have to go back there and see what else is written in Yirmiyahu about the latter days. But here are a couple of good witnesses, and thus we should see these two nations, Moab and Elam, for example, in the latter days. We should see these peoples being brought down low yet again, because we know that he often does things in cycles. And in the latter days, that's going to be kind of like a final cycle. Let's say the final rinse, like when you're in a washing job inside of a washer. Okay. You've got cycles going on there. Well, usually the last one is a big, heavy rinse, you know, before the, pulling out of all the water. And certainly these people deserve such a tumble, so to speak. So anyway, I'm with you there, MC, on Yah's putting out there the words about latter days. It should be considered. Absolutely.
All right.
Well, and that's what I have through the end of the chapter.
We'll certainly do that. And so I'll ask the question, and we've got about 15 minutes or so in the hour. MP or Ken, either one of you got anything else on anything we've talked about up through the end of chapter 49 at this point?
I think the only thing I had to say was the fact that, yeah, we've now touched on all of these nations that that were surrounding the land of Yisrael, or their land, I should say, Yah's land, the land where his children Yisrael were settled and at rest until they fell into sin. And then, of course, they are overtaken by all of these countries in one way or another. They are influenced, they're put down, they're scorned, they're mocked. Often they're brought into captivity, and all of these nations too will also be brought down. So there is no exception, and I believe this is the end before we get to the great and powerful Babylon itself. So that's all I would have to say up until the end of this chapter.
Okay.
I thought you were going to say the great and powerful Oz there.
Yeah, we were all
maybe similar.
Okay, let's continue to chapter 50, and we'll do the first section here, which has to do with the coming destruction of Babylon. And it says this, the word that Yahuwah spoke against Babylon and against the land of the Chaldeans by Yirmiyahu the prophet. Declare among the nations, proclaim and set up a standard, proclaim, do not conceal, say, Babylon is taken, Bel is shamed, Merodach is broken in pieces, her idols are humiliated, her images are broken in pieces, for out of the north a nation comes up against her, which shall make her land desolate, and no one shall dwell therein. They shall move, they shall depart, both man and beast. And I'll read two more verses to put a good stopping place in line. In those days and in that time, says Yahuwah, the children of Israel shall come, they and the children of Judah together. Now, I'm going to pause and, as I do so often, note that one of the things that I contend that the whore church completely screwed up, overlooked for a bunch of reasons that we've talked about literally for a number of years at this point, is this whole idea of two kingdoms, two whoring houses, two wives, each of whom, both of whom, have fallen into idolatry, adultery, and have been exiled for cause. And I sometimes refer to the northern kingdom, Israel, the whoring church, and the southern kingdom, Judah, as the whore synagogue. And basically, there's plenty of blame to go around. And notice that he says it here, in those days and in that times, says Yahuwah, the children of Israel shall come. Now, this sense, given what we see in the rest of the verse, certainly looks like we're talking about the northern kingdom. They and the children of Judah together, the southern kingdom. So, if you will, the whore church in the north, the whore synagogue, they shall come together. With continual weeping they shall come and seek Yahuwah their El. They shall ask the way to Zion with their faces toward it, saying, come and let us join ourselves to Yahuwah in a perpetual covenant that will not be forgotten. And I can't help but think, forgotten again in this case, because that's how they got into this place and this situation in the first place. All right, who wants to go first? Mark, let's go to you at this point.
All right, let's see. I'm going to open with Ozamra's commentary on verses 1 to 3, then I'm going to comment on verses 1 to 3. How do you like that? Okay, so here's Ozamra. They say, prophecy of the destruction of Babylon. Jeremiah's ministry fell at the very height of Babylonian might and dominion. Yet he still prophesied that she would fall, unlikely as this may have seemed to the people of his time. For the nation has come up against her from the north. This refers to Media and Persia, who under Darius and Cyrus, respectively overthrew Babylon in the time of Nebuchadnezzar's grandson Belshazzar, as described in the book of Daniel. Now, Babylon is the land of the Chaldees. Okay? Yah is doing this by the hand of Yirmiyahu, the prophet. Verse 2 gives me the impression that Yah wants it known far and wide exactly who it is that's bringing judgment against Babylon and Chaldea. Declare out loud. Raise a flag on the highest pole. Put up the billboards. Make the FCC take over the airwaves. Make sure everyone on earth knows that it is Yah who is bringing this calamity on Babylon, because there is none else who can. Let me add this on 31 May 2022, in the aftermath of the COVID falderal and the midst of all the other garbage news the manipulators of the earth are showering us with, here's what it says. Yah take vengeance on the wicked world rulers at this time and replace those unbelieving men and women with servants of your own, who will consider you and your ways in all that they do, and then protect them and their hearts in their service to you, and make this world a place where you are universally glorified. In your name and the name of your son Yeshua, so let it be. Okay, now, getting back to the text, we need a real intervention by Yah to straighten this place out right now, and that's what I just prayed for. Okay, getting back to the text, in verse 2, a nation is coming against Babylon while her idols are confounded and broken in pieces. Treasury of Scripture Knowledge has this, I've got this in my Blue Letter Bible, and sometimes they've got some good stuff. Xerxes, after his return from his unsuccessful expedition into Greece, partly out of religious zeal, being a professed enemy to image worship, the Persian Empire was Zoroastrian, they had one god, okay, I put that in there, and partly to reimburse himself after his immense expenses, seized the sacred treasures and plundered and destroyed the temples and idols of Babylon, thereby accomplishing the prophecies of Isaiah and Jeremiah in Isaiah 21:9 and 46:1, and in Jeremiah 50 in verse 2, 51 in verse 44, and 47 and 52. What God literally declares, I will punish Bel in Babylon, and I will bring forth that which he has swallowed, was also literally fulfilled when the vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar had brought from Jerusalem and placed in the temple of Bel in Daniel 1:2, were restored by order of Cyrus, Koresh, in Ezra chapter 1 and verse 7, and again carried to Jerusalem. That according to Bishop Newton in his dissertation 10. Now, the nation coming against Babylon is Persia, and it's very soon going to fall to Koresh, the Mede, and is prophesied in verse 3. This will be good for Yehuda because the Medo-Persian Empire was Zoroastrian, which was a monotheist religion. They may have seen Yah as the same Elohim as Zoroaster by a different name. That would be an easy assumption since almost all cultures of the day were either multi-theistic, each different natural wonder being attributed to a different god, or pantheistic, everything except us is God, which ultimately makes us God. And that's pretty much what they're talking about there, and that's what I got through verse 3.
All right, go ahead, Ken.
Ken.
Okay, I'm going to focus on 1 and 2 first here.
There you go.
Now, of course, we should have guessed that Babylon, in the land of the Chaldeans, would be the last of the pagan nations to fall to Yahuwah. After all, he used them to bring down all of the rest. And Yah wants all to know that Babylon has fallen. He starts with her authorities, right? He starts with her authorities. Now, according to the Encyclopedia Britannica, Marduk, and notice that name, Marduk, because here in verse 2 we're talking about something pronounced as Merodok. Okay, yep. Marduk in Mesopotamian religion was the chief god of the city of Babylon and the national god of Babylonia. As such, he was eventually called simply Bel or Lord. Originally, he seems to have been a god of thunderstorms. A poem known as the Enuma Elish, and dating from the reign of Nebuchadnezzar the First, from 1119 through 1098 BCE, relates Marduk's rise to such preeminence that he was the god of 50 names, each one that of a deity or of a divine attribute. After conquering the monster of primeval chaos, this Tiamat, he became lord of the gods of heaven and earth. All nature, including humanity, owed its existence to him. The destiny of kingdoms and subjects was in his hands. Marduk was later known as Bel, a name derived from the Semitic word Baal or Lord. Bel had all the attributes of Marduk, and his status and cult were much the same. Bel, however, gradually came to be thought of as the god of order and destiny. So now verse 2, you see these two names, Bel and Marduk. Verse 2 says that Bel is confounded in the King James Version. Confounded is the Hebrew word yabash, or yabesh, sorry, yabesh. Considering a god has no power of its own, I like to give a couple of other scriptural examples of this word, yabesh, to possibly give us a little better understanding than just, oh, this god was confounded, okay? The very first instances of yabesh in scripture is Bereshit or Genesis 8 verse 7, and is rendered as the words dried up, where it is written, and this is Bereshit 8 verse 7, and he sent forth a raven, which went forth to and fro, until the waters were dried up from off the earth. And remember, that's in the days of Noah and the flood, and this is right after the flood. Now consider how water disappears from the earth. It's not a quick process, but consistent until dissipated. It seems to disappear before our own eyes. Okay, so that's one.
Okay. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay. Sometimes I lay under the moon.
Welcome to the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Apostolic Edition, with your hosts Rob Miller, Mark Petron, and yours truly, Mark Call. We hope you'll find this discussion entertaining, thought-provoking, and that above all, you'll be like the Bereans and search out the scriptures for yourself to see if these things be true.
I've been praying for the people to say that we don't want to fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will pay.
All right. Good afternoon, folks. Once again, welcome back to the second hour of the Torah Teachers Roundtable, Tanakh edition. And we're talking about the book of Yirmiyahu, moving into chapter 50, and more of the judgments on, in this case, Babylon. And irony here, of course, is that Babylon was used by Yah to perform judgments on all these other nations, and in particular on his people. And then once it's done used for that, once it's done being used for that reason, now there's going to be a judgment on Babylon itself. So this is kind of a standard procedure we've seen throughout history. And let me ask the question. I guess we interrupted Ken. Is that right, Ken? Have you got more you want to add?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I was right in the middle of explaining this word, Yabesh, which is Strong's number H3001, rendered here in the King James as confounded. Bel is confounded. So the first instance I shared was Breshit, or Genesis 8, verse 7, where it's translated as dried up, where the waters were dried up from off the earth. And consider, you know, what that means in your mind, how water dissipates and just dries up and goes away. Now, here's another example of Yabesh, but rendered as the word withered. Is that my kitty? Oh, yeah. My kitty's getting all boisterous here. Psalm 102, verse 4. My heart is smitten and withered like grass, so that I forget to eat my bread. So over a limited amount of time, grass grows and dies, depending on temperatures. Its withered state can come very quickly, depending on conditions and the environment. And Yah is likening such withering to the heart, where is one's thoughts and spirit. One is truly brought down or even fallen when the heart is withered to a certain extent. So in these two examples, right, being dried up and dissipated completely and withered as grass withers and dies and, again, blows away, really, as chaff, we can see the similar context of how quickly something may degrade and eventually reach a state of decay or even disappearance. So consider this when reading the word Yabesh. Now, I believe this is to tell us that no more was Bel in their hearts and minds, nor in their activities surrounding the fall of Babylon. And broken in pieces can truly indicate its lack of effectiveness in one's life. Yah goes on to say that all of Babylon's idols and images are the same, withered and broken into pieces. There is most assuredly no power in them. When Yah's power shines forth to reveal the truth in all matters. And all I can say is hallelujah to that, right?
Man.
What was that, MP?
I said I'm in.
Yeah, I'm in.
Hallelujah to that.
Yes, I agree. Now, I have a comment here on verses 3 to 6, which I'll go ahead and I know we didn't read through six, but we'll catch up on that here in just a sec. Here, three through six, we see a nation from the north that would swoop down and make Babylon desolate. Now, but more importantly, we see Yah specify the state of his people, Yisrael, at this time period, seeking him in their travail. And not since hundreds of years earlier will Yisrael, the northern tribes, and Yehuda, the southern tribe, or tribes, I should say, be yachad, or one unit. We see the word yachad here, not echad, but yachad, meaning one unit. They will be in travail, but will be seeking Yah. And more importantly, they do not want to forget the covenant with Yah. Hallelujah to that. This is truly joining with him, with Yahuwah, and seeking his walk and his ways. Yah goes on to say that for a long time, for so long, they have been lost sheep and led by wicked shepherds. Boy, does that sound like the people of this nation and actually the people of this earth in today's day and age. We see a lot of good examples, even in today's religions. I believe turning back from the mountains and settled on hills and forgetting their resting place would point to falling into less spiritual surroundings. Because remember, Yah is all about being high on the mountains and all about resting on Shabbat. And we know how paying attention to the world can get one riled up and confused and twisted into believing and putting something more important that is often twisted and sometimes even our lies, you know, are put forth and made more important than anything else. But so that's what the world does. It riles us up. It helps us forget the rest that Yah dictates we enjoy week to week in his Shabbat. I mean, even for those who, you know, centuries and centuries ago began to rest on Sundays. Okay, the day was off a little there. But still, they at least still had a resting day. I think a lot of them forget that too. Yep. It's just everything about worship of the creator of this world is just being put away, you know, tucked away, made less important. That's what you call in vain, made a little, you know. His word has been made a little, and shame on all the world. And all of these nations. And so anyway, that's what I see up to verse 6. So I'll go ahead and stop it there.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I'm going to open with a Zamra on verses 4 through 8, and then I'll comment on verses 4 and 5. Anyway, the salvation and restoration of Zion after the destruction of Babylon, that's what we're looking at here. In those days and at that time, the children of Israel shall come, they and the children of Judah together, according to verse 4. Now, the collapse of Babylon would lead to the restoration of Judah, and with them whose numbers, members of the 10 tribes who remembered, or rather, who remained in the land of Babylon, of Ira. We start that all over again. The collapse of Babylon would lead to the restoration of Judah, and with them those members of the 10 tribes who remained in the land of Israel after the exile of their brothers and who attached themselves to Judah, accompanying them into exile in Babylon. That according to Metzudat, David, Radak on verse 4. Simultaneously, this prophecy of the unification of Israel and Judah surely also refers to the eventual return of all the exiled 10 tribes and their reconciliation with Judah at the end of days. The verses 5 through 8, referring to the salvation, have eternal significance and are not bound only to the return to Zion in the days of Ezra after the fall of Babylon. Okay, so that goes on into perpetuity. Now, verse 4 says that when Babylon falls to Media Persia, whole Israel shall return to their land weeping, I think out of joy at their return home, but also in lament after seeing what has become of the land. Those who can remember will see a waste that the land had become, but will also realize that it is theirs once again, for a while anyway. And those who have never seen the land, but understand that it is their land, not someone else's whom they serve in bondage. I think these tears are more for joy than for sorrow. The wonderful thing is that they will be going to seek Yah Elohechem. Okay? In verse 5, all the way back, they will be asking, which way to Zion? To everyone they encounter, both Israel and Yehuda will be looking for the Temple Mount, on which they will build a replacement of sorts, which those old-timers like MC and I will weep over when we remember the grandeur of Shlomo's temple. Well, okay, Ken would also weep, but he's a bit younger than me and a lot younger than MC. Anyway, but they will be home.
And unlike MP, he doesn't remember Solomon's temple.
After a long separation and a joyful weeping will be universal. Go ahead, Mark.
No, I just said, unlike Mark, he doesn't remember Solomon's temple. So, take it for what it's worth.
Okay, that's what I got through verse 5.
Okay, I think we're ready to read on then. Is that correct, guys? Ken?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, so where we are at this point is we have this this prophecy that in those days and in that time, the children of Israel will come along with the children of Judah. They shall seek Yahuwah their El. And my people, he says in verse 6, have been lost sheep. Their shepherds have led them astray. They've turned them away on the mountains. They've gone from mountain to hill. They have forgotten their resting place. All who found them have devoured them. And their adversaries said, we have not offended, because they have sinned against Yahuwah, the habitation of justice, Yahuwah, the hope of their fathers. So move from the midst of Babylon. Go out of the land of the Chaldeans and be like the rams before the flocks. For behold, I will raise and cause to come up against Babylon an assembly of great nations from the north country. And they shall array themselves against her. From there she shall be captured. Their arrows shall be like those of an expert warrior. None shall return in vain. And Chaldea shall become plunder. All who plunder her shall be satisfied, says Yahuwah. Let's pause there. And Ken, we'll go to you first this time.
Okay. Verse 7. If all have found them, have devoured them, surely they were not walking in Yah's ways. He would have afforded protection and built them up to be a much stronger force than any other. But instead, Yah allows others to humiliate them, especially since those nations have learned enough to know that Yah allows them to defeat the children of Israel when they are in sin. I like this term, habitation of justice. I think that's well fitting in verse 7. Verse 8, note that Yah is speaking to those in Babylon, partaking in her sins. And there should be leaders of the flock that influence others to leave Babylon. Now, I can't help but recall these verses, which sound one and the same with what's happening in the days of Yirmiyahu. This is in the book of Revelation, chapter 18, verses 2 through 4, where it's written, and he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and is become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. Now, I believe both, meaning what we're reading now in Yirmiyahu, chapter 50, verse 8, and what's written here in Revelation 18, verses 2 through 4, I believe both to be yet another spiritual battle, okay, spiritual battles, in which many are comfortable in the ways of the wicked. Okay, they're comfortable in their these traditions, these customs, but need to turn from their evil ways and flee such filth. Now, I see that as a good example of how we are today. We have people who are comfortable in these wicked ways. They are all about, you know, trading, wicked results for money. They take the money and they just simply, you know, either turn another face, turn their eyes away from the wickedness going on. They vote along with what they shouldn't be voting for. And I'm speaking of course, our Congress people and our senators.
Amen.
You know, even on the Republican side, sad to say.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And that's there's your false dichotomy again, in other words. That's somehow or other, if
right,
you're a part of the different wing of the same bird of prey, it's better, I guess. It takes a while to figure that out.
Yeah, and to swallow it.
There are 10, 12 guys in the Senate that are straight.
Yeah, that's about
there
it.
There might be twice as many in the House that are straight, and all the rest are so.
Yep. sad thing is you see the same thing going on with doctors and nurses of today. You know,
right.
They know a lot of them know the truth of COVID and of the vaccine, the so-called vaccine. It's not really a vaccine, but they know the truth of it. But yet they continue in the lie so that they can keep their jobs. And often that's at the cost of killing people, literally losing lives.
Well, okay,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
When you put it that way, Ken, I mean, you're right. The Bible uses the term either harlot or whore, and I think whore is at least more descriptive nowadays because that's what we're talking about. But unlike a harlot or a whore who sells her body in exchange for money or, that kind of thing, what we have today with, you mentioned the doctors, those that literally tell somebody else, hey, I want to inject your body. I want to put something into your body, right? The whore puts something into her body from somebody else for money. This guy is willing to not only whore somebody else's body out, but in the process kill them. And literally, the doctors ought to know better. The fact that they don't know better is either massive dereliction or it's worse than whoring. And you're right. I mean, of all the things that are being described here, the level of evil, I think that's the thing that we got to keep emphasizing. He talks about priests that don't teach my people the difference between the clean and the unclean. And what we're talking about are far worse than whoring priests. These are literally individuals that are willing to whore somebody else out.
They're murderous doctors.
Say that again, Mark.
Mm-hmm. And nurses. Yep. All of them. Absolutely. Yep. Anyway, that's what I see through verse 8, that it's spiritual battle. You know, just that's what was going on in Revelation, and I believe that's what we're seeing here in Yirmiyahu. Now, verses 9 through 10, now this is according to the World History Encyclopedia, okay? Cyrus II, around the year 530 BCE, also known as Cyrus the Great, was the fourth king of Anshan and the first king of Achaemenid Empire. The Achaemenid Empire, if I said that right, I don't know. Cyrus led several military campaigns against the most powerful kingdoms of the time, including the Medes, their Media, Lydia, and Babylonia. Through these campaigns, he united much of the Middle East under Persian hegemony, meaning where, you know, he is sort of leading all the other smaller or lesser nations to do his bidding, while keeping the local administration mostly intact by guaranteeing some continuity and thus winning the loyalty of the elite. He laid the foundations for the Achaemenid Empire. Thus the words in verse 8, an assembly of great nations, is fitting in that many nations in that region fought together under Persian leadership to defeat Babylon and other nations in that region. And since Chaldea is a part of Babylon, it will be a spoil of war. And that's what I have through verse 10.
All right. Let me cover 6 through 8 anyway. As happens all too often in our own day, the sheep follow wicked shepherds. They hear what the self-appointed shepherds, I can probably rattle off 5 or 6 politicians and lamestream news pundits without too much trouble, say what that sounds reasonable, okay, until you get a chance to think about it for a minute. But that gets them moving 180 degrees out of the way to be desired destination, to their desired destination. There was a reason for temples being built on a prominent hill, so that people could see their destination from almost anywhere, not over the horizon. Yehuda has been away from Zion long enough that they might have to search for it, especially since Nebuchadnezzar had had Shlomo's temple taken down to the last stone and then the stones removed. Fortunately, there were some in the returning entourage that remembered which hill it had been on. Maybe they remembered the Mount of Olives was due east of the Temple Mount. I don't know. But in 1 Peter 2:25 it says, "For ye were as sheep gone astray, but are now returned unto the shepherd and bishop of your souls." The same can be said of those Yehudi who are returning to their land after this long exile. Now, verse 7 says that everyone who came upon Yehuda in its return home was taking advantage of them, and that Yah wouldn't judge them for it, since Yehuda had defied and turned against Yah, which was the reason for their exile. They must have been under the impression that Yah was still angry with Yehuda, when in fact his anger was abated by their calling out to him for deliverance, and he had accepted them back. The heathen didn't have a clue about an Elohim who would abate his anger and judgment against his people if they would turn back to him in repentance. They figured, we aren't offending Yah like his own people did. But for a time, that was true, but Yehuda had repented and been accepted back into fellowship. Now Yah was tallying up the offenses against the intruders who had taken Yehuda's land in their absence. So Yah tells Yehuda in verse 8, "Get gone from Babylon before Medo-Persia shows up to devour it, and get back home and inhabit the hills like flocks of goats, because I am sending trouble Babylon's way." Proverbs 30 and verses 29 to 31 say this, There be three which go well, yea, four are coming comely in going. A lion, the strongest among beasts, and turneth not away from any. A greyhound, an he-goat also, and a king against whom none rises up. That's Proverbs 30 and verses 29 to 31. These things are all related. It's one sentence. Why the greyhound? It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It isn't talking about the breed of dog. There are two seemingly unrelated Hebrew words used here. Zarzir, kind of a doubling of the Hebrews 21:15, zur, to separate out from others, like ringing something in, surrounding. And moten, to firm or to strengthen. The lion doesn't take nothing from nobody. This king don't take nothing from nobody. So why the goat and the greyhound?
Okay, we are back. This is the final segment for today. We're talking about Yirmiyahu chapter 50 at this point. And let's see. Looks like we interrupted MP, and I'll let him pick it back up again. Jackals and other things, as I recall, but we'll see where we are.
All right. Thank you. Let's see. Okay. The heathen, I'm starting back up around verse 7. The heathen didn't have a clue about an Elohim who would abate his anger and judgment against his people if they would turn back to him in repentance. They figured, we aren't offending Yehovah like his people did. And for a time, that was true. But Yehuda had repented and had been accepted back into fellowship. Now Yah was tallying up the offenses against the intruders who had taken Yehuda's land in their absence. So Yah tells Yehuda in verse 8, get gone from Babylon before Medo-Persia shows up to devour it, and get back home and inhabit the hills like flocks of goats, because I am sending trouble Babylon's way. He says in Proverbs chapter 30 and verses 29-31, there are three which go well, yea, four are comely in going. A lion, the strongest among beasts, and turneth not away from any. A greyhound, and he goat also, and a king, against whom none rises up. Now these things are all related in one sentence. Why the greyhound? It isn't talking about a breed of dog. There are two distinct, seemingly unrelated Hebrew words used here. Zarzir, kind of a doubling of the Hebrew 21:15 sur, to separate out from others, like bringing something in or surrounding something, okay? And moten, mem tav nun, to fur, to strengthen. The lion don't take nothing from nobody. This king doesn't take nothing from nobody. So why the goat and the greyhound? Looks to me like the goat and greyhound are being protected by the lion and the king. I surmise that the goat and the greyhound represents their subjects, the king, and their pride, the lion. But the he-goat ain't exactly helpless in his own defense, and the greyhound can literally run rings around his attackers. As it applies in Jeremiah 50 and verse 8, Yehuda is told to head for home because Medo-Persia is going to destroy the Babylonian Empire, and they are going to need all the attributes of all the entities in Proverbs 30, verses 29-31, both on the way and when they get home. And here's 29-31 again, because I read it before. There are be three which do go well, yea, four are comely in going. A lion, the strongest among beasts, and turneth not away any, for any. A greyhound, and he-goat, and a king, against whom none rises up. Okay, so they are going to encounter the present residents of their homeland, who will not give any of it back easily. Life is going to be touch and go when they get back to the land. And that's what I got through verse 8. And I got a little bit left for verses 9 through 12. So go ahead. Go ahead, Ken.
I think we need to read on just a little bit because I commented through verse 10. And I think I don't know if MC read that far.
Let's see.
Well, let's.
The arrows don't return in vain. And yeah, we got through verse 10. All who plunder her shall be satisfied. Talking about Chaldea, says Yahuwah. Because you were glad, because you rejoiced, you destroyers of my heritage. Wait a second. Does that sound like something we might see today, too? Yeah, the parallels here ought to not pass over us.
Yes, it is.
They are rejoicing in the destruction of America and in the slaughter of aborted kids and in grade schools, because that'll give us an excuse to take away the ability of people to prevent the rest of the slaughter we got planned. Because you were glad and you rejoiced, you destroyers of my heritage, because you've grown fat like heifer threshing grain, and you bellow like bulls, especially if there's dead kids around, your mother shall be deeply ashamed. She who bore you shall be ashamed. Behold, the least of the nations shall be a wilderness, a dry land and a desert. Because of the wrath of Yahuwah, she shall not be inhabited, but she shall be wholly desolate. Everyone who goes by Babylon shall be horrified and hiss at all her plagues. So let's pause there, and I'll just ask one question. I'll go back to Ken in just a second here. But remember, I am not one who believes that America is Babylon, but I do think America is certainly at least the greater Babylon metro area. And Babylon, of course, is one of those things that appears in multiple references. And this was talking about it then, and I can't help but think, yeah, we're going to see an end times version as well. And remember, too, Babylon is a system, not just a religious system, but an economic system, a political system, a social system, a religious system.
That's right.
It's a beast system. Go ahead.
It's a beast system, exactly right.
Yeah, verses 11 to 13. Babylon was so great for such a time that her pride would be brought down by greater wrath from Yah. As is common, to be likened to heifers and bulls is a good example of the largeness of this nation. But as with all who fall to Yah, even Babylon will be brought low, even as unto a wilderness or desert. She will not be inhabited and will surely be desolate. I mean, that's simply because Yah spoke it. This leaves nothing for others to desire, and often for others to scorn and mock. And thus is the wrath of Yah to those who continue in such pagan ways. And yeah, we saw these ways in that day. And just like as I think many of us here in the room are speaking about, we see these same ways occurring today, in these days, especially in terms of fatness, to see how fat people are making themselves when they're in power. Oh, we see this all over the place. Now, all you have to do is do a little bit of research, and you find out that these Congress people, senators, certain people who work for the government, such as Fauci, you know, all these type of people, they're making millions and millions of dollars in all the wrong ways. They're being made fat.
Yeah, making millions and millions of dollars on the patents for the vaccines.
Only, guys, it's tens of millions or hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars, because as they are making their hundreds of millions, they're also printing money, and those who bless them are printing the money, and they're destroying the basis of the dishonest weights and measures. So it's all about destroying so much and living fat. When you were talking about fatness, though, Ken, I couldn't help but think, hey, you know, they may even have a special freezer just for all of their ice cream that they can eat while you people are starving.
That's for Joe. Yeah, for Sleepy Joe.
Maybe that'll keep him awake, huh? I don't know. It might take a lot more than just ice cream. But yeah, in any case, we can see the ways and the witnesses of Babylon all over the place in today's world. And I think that's why we read about Babylon in the book of Revelation, because often Yah uses terms and phrases in epithet ways, meaning that, yeah, we can see it physically in that day, but later it would be a nation likened to Babylon, and thus he would call it Babylon. And that's the way Yah works throughout his scripture.
I really think that there has been a Babylon ever since Babylon existed in real life, okay? There has been a spiritual Babylon that has been with us all of that time, okay? In different places and led by different people, but Babylon is just the world system. It's what it is.
Yeah, amen. And yeah, that's pretty much what I was seeing through verse 13. So I'll go ahead and let you take over, MP.
All right. Well, I haven't got anything on verse 13. I got a little bit on verse 13. Okay, so I can go that far. Zamra says in verse, I'm covering verses 9 through 12 here. In verses 9 through 16, it says the depiction of the vengeance against Babylon and its fall. Now, an assembly is coming against Babylon. This is not one nation, but several of them. TSK says on verse 9, the army of Koresh was composed of Medes, Persians, Armenians, Caducians, Sais, and etc., all of which arranged under the Medes came from the north. Now, just look at the nations coming against Babylon. Some are larger, greater than others, but none are panty-waists in their own right. And they are working together to throw off the bondage that they had been under for perhaps 70 years. They were tired of it, so they got together enough fighters to take Babylon down. Notice that most have come from the north. What is due north of what is Babylon proper back then? Let's see, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Russia. Those are some of the present-day lands that came against Babylon. And it was a long but relatively easy march due south between the Caspian and Black Seas until they got to the Euphrates headwaters in modern-day Georgia, where they could just walk alongside the river. Anyway, verse 10 says that Chaldea shall be a spoil, and that everyone who takes part in that spoil will be satisfied with their takings. And Yah is bringing this against Babylon because they took such pleasure in the destruction and the taking at the cost of their own victim, Yehuda. Isn't it funny, not ha-ha, but peculiar, that Yah allowed the Chaldeans to plunder Yehuda because Yehuda had rebelled against his word and turned against him and his requirements from them to worship him and him alone. He gave Yehuda their land, and they repaid him with their worship of idols that could not truly satisfy their spirits, and with rebellion against his word, which protected them from all manner of harm, temporal and spiritual. The Hebrew root behind the word satisfied is the Hebrew 7646 saba, or sabaya, to satisfy or to be full of. Now, in verses 11 to 12, it seems in verses 11 and 12 that Babylon wasn't satisfied with having all the riches of Yehuda, which were considerable, but just had to rejoice at the destruction of Yehuda, as Mordecai would have done except for Hadassah Esther. Israel Yehuda was always the red-haired stepchild among the nations of the earth. Yehuda was in pretty good shape under Nebuchadnezzar and Daniel, but toward the end of the empire, the emperors went the way of many long-standing empires. The later emperors became tyrants, being much smaller men than the original king had been, regardless of their comparative physical stature. Alexander the Great was not named for his physique, but his knowledge of war, like Nebuchadnezzar had been. Just because they could make a racket didn't mean they knew how to use one. So, because of the Chaldees, had grown fat and sassy over time and decided to treat their vassals as vassals, Yah worked against them and took them down. That's what I got through verse 12.
Are we ready to read on? Are we? You got anything you want to add before we do that, Ken?
No, I read through verse 13, so yeah, we need to read on a little bit.
Okay. And we're talking about the last I read was about the hissing at all of her plagues. Okay. You know, and sometimes you read through this and you see these things and you go, wow, is he talking about the current headlines? Because it so much fits that you honestly have to be almost blind not to see it here. Put yourselves in array, it says in verse 14, against Babylon.
It repeats itself over and over again.
I'm sorry, say again, Mark?
Yeah. I say history repeats itself over and over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, Yah went through a whole list of things with the original creation before the flood, okay? And after the flood was over, he had to go through it all over again. And he did it over and over and over and over and over again. And we just don't get it. Okay? That's the point. It just doesn't take in our brains that Yah has done all these things and he's told us all these things and it's really not that complicated. But we just don't seem to get it. We don't seem to want to get it. That's all I got on that.
Okay. So, put yourselves in array against Babylon, you who bend the bow. Shoot at her, spare no arrows, for she has sinned against Yahuwah. Shout against her all around. She has given her hand, her foundations have fallen, her walls are thrown down, for it is the vengeance of Yahuwah. Take vengeance on her, as she has done, so do to her. And I'm going to pause and just let that sink in for a second. As Babylon and the greater Babylon metro area has done, so do to her. Has the entire world now been polluted with dishonest weights and measures? Has Disneyland not basically tried to pervert and groom kids, not just in America, but worldwide? We have, you name it, America is exporting perversion all over the place. Cut off the sower from Babylon, it continues, and him who handles the sickle at harvest time. How about cut off the fertilizer, cut off the ability of them to plant crops, to harvest crops, to ship crops? For fear of the oppressing sword, everyone shall turn to his own people, and everyone shall flee to his own land. Israel is like scattered sheep. The lions have driven him away. First the king of Assyria devoured him, and now at last this Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, has broken his bones. I'm going to read the therefore part, and then we'll pause. We've got about 5 minutes left at that point. Therefore, thus says Yahuwah Zevuot, Elohim of Israel, behold, I will punish the king of Babylon and his land. I gotta wonder, does that even include the imposter king of Babylon? Okay, as I have punished the king of Assyria, but I will bring back Israel to his home, and he shall feed on Carmel and Bashan. His soul shall be satisfied on Mount Ephraim and Gilead. In those days and in that time, says Yahuwah, the Torahlessness, the iniquity of Israel shall be sought, but there shall be none. And the sins of Judah, but they shall not be found. For I will pardon those whom I preserve. So here again, the reference to both whoring kingdoms, the whore church and the whore synagogue, and in those days it'll be said that the Torahlessness will be sought but not found, because the sins of Judah, they won't be found either. I will pardon those whom I preserve. So let's pause at that point.
What verse did you read through there, MC?
Through 20. So, yep. 20. Go ahead.
I will pardon them whom I reserve. Okay. Yeah, I'll take that. So 14 and 15, Yah desires that all come against her in battle. And this is the vengeance of Yah, and thus is surely justified. And to do unto her as she has done to others would be well known by all others, not only just in this region, but possibly across the world at that time, for Babylon was very, very great. And the funny thing is, if you then associate Babylon with today, I think it's the same. I think not just those in, let's say, in America, but all over the world, many eyes have been opened to see what this beast system is doing. It's amazing. I mean, I think it was apparent then, and it's becoming apparent now even. Now verses 16 and 17, I like to consider the more spiritual understanding of these words in terms of sowing and harvesting. So up until this point, Babylon has been a growing and thriving culture, right? Growing its border while defeating many nations. Now that this nation is to fall, this people will no longer thrive in its culture to include sharing and even pushing the belief in their gods and following their pagan customs. And this is a chance for those captives to return to their lands. Yah again points to his people, Yisrael, to remind those who can hear how they have fallen to their enemies and their neighbors as scattered sheep. They were scattered into their captive lands and thus driven out of their own land more than once. Now, of course, I'm speaking of Yisrael, and by more than one great nation. So that's what we're seeing in verses 16 and 17, you know, regarding Yisrael. Now, verses 18 to 20, Yah first prophesies that the bringing down of the Babylonian king will be likened to the bringing down of the Assyrian king in the past. And such prophecy is put out there for even further proof of how wonderful and full of wisdom our Creator is. He also lets the world know that Yisrael will be brought back to the land. We should see such things happen near the same time. And the wonderful news that her sins will be forgiven would certainly give her much hope. And now, of course, again, I'm speaking of her as being Yisrael, which very well could be us. Now, even though she has fallen short time and time again, and it's funny because we see her falling short throughout the scroll of Yirmiyahu. Oh my gosh, how many times? Like hundreds. Probably hundreds of times. She has fallen short over and over again. And of course, Yah winks at ignorance. Yah gives more than one chance. Yah, you know, looks back and remembers her in her captivity. She, being Yisrael, is truly the love of Yah. That's all there is to it. Okay, Yah loves his children, and he always turns back to his children, even after they've been punished so severely. And there always seems to be a remnant. We should always see that there's always a remnant, no matter how bad we think things are. Like, as in, even today, I think a lot of us say, "Oh my word, look at this beast system! Look how it's overtaking everyone, you know, is there any hope for us?" But we should always consider what's happened through Scripture, that Yah makes it look this way, you know, but there's always a remnant, and of course, Yah turns everything around. He turns evil into good, and that's what happens in the end of days. We know that will happen, that evil will be put away and good will prevail. And so no matter how, you know, low we feel in this Babylonian system, which I believe we're in today, I think a lot of people even preach that throughout many different religions, that we're in this Babylonian system, and a lot of us are not sure how we can escape it. You know, it has too much power. And yep. Truly it does, you know? Yeah. it has found a way to encompass every aspect of our lives. And it's literally, little by little, taking over every little aspect of our lives. Yep. And Yah, though, will turn all of that around.
That up note, we will end for today. We'll pick it up and finish chapter 50 next time. Hey, thanks, guys. Show up, folks.